But right now, very happy to welcome to the show Heather Bouget. She's executive director and chief economist at the Washington Center for Equitable Growth. The New York Times has called her one of the most vibrant voices in the field. Politico twice named her one of the top 50 thinkers, doers, and visionaries transforming American politics. And we're going to talk about income inequality. So we are all on the same page here. Heather, thanks for being on the show. I appreciate it.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Sure. So, Heather, I wanted to talk about, first, income inequality, what it means, you know, what the impact is, and then get to the point of the GOP tax plan, how that impacts that. So, first, let's do, like, income inequality one-on-one, because, you know, President Obama called rising income inequality the defining challenge of our time. So we're all on the same page, and so I'm on the same page. How would you define income inequality in terms of the United States?
Well, it's a fairly simple question in the sense that what we've seen for decades now is that the gains of economic growth have been going primarily to those at the top of the income distribution, and not just, you know, the top 20% or the top 10%, but to the folks, the very small number of people at the very, very top of the income spectrum have garnered, you know, the vast majority of the gains from growth. Some new data out from colleagues Emmanuel Saez and Thomas Piketty and others show that here in the United States, we have the bottom half of the population of adults here in America has seen about a 5% gain in income between 1980 and about, I think, 2016. Those in the top 0.001% have seen their incomes grow by almost 630%. So that's just a remarkable gap in who is seeing the gains of economic growth. And more of that income from folks at the very top isn't coming from wages and salaries, like what most people in America get their income from, you know, the sweat of their brow or the how fast their fingers, you know, move across the computer keyboard. Income for those at the top is primarily from capital investments, and that could either be because they've invested in a factory or a firm or because they're just getting rents of some sort. And that really changes what our economy looks like and changes the incentives. And so we're seeing this very large and significant increase in income inequality and wealth inequality over time. And we're seeing a difference in how people at the top are earning that high income in ways that will have long-term implications for growth and vitality of our economy for decades to come.
And that's what I want to get into next. Why does it matter? And I read this. Tell me if this is correct, Heather. I've read in a few places that income inequality gap now, the difference between the rich and the poor, has returned to levels last seen in the 1920s, right before the Great Depression. Is that accurate?
Oh, yes, that is certainly accurate. And, you know, one thing I was reading this afternoon is, you know, they call that the Gilded Age. Mm-hmm. And they called it the Gilded Age not because it was so great and there was gold everywhere, but because it was sort of this sheen of veneer on top of a rotten system where only a few at the top got the gains from growth and they weren't focused on benefiting everyone in that society. So this is exactly where we are. We're right back where we started nearly a century ago.
So now the big question, why does it matter for our nation that we have such a gross inequity between the rich and the poor and the gap is continuing to grow?
Well, there's a number of ways that it affects us. I mean, certainly it insults our sense of fairness, mm-hmm. right? But, I mean, I'm an economist, and so I spend my time thinking about what does this do to the economy? And there is mounting evidence that this high inequality is dragging down economic growth. It is destabilizing, so it's distorting growth and making it less stable over time. And it's obstructing opportunity for economic mobility, for people to, you know, who have a great idea or who are smart to be able to get that idea into the marketplace. And that evidence is also mounting, that high inequality is actually preventing new ideas from bubbling up and from people seeing the gains of those ideas. But also, if new ideas can't bubble up, you've stymied what is best about American capitalism, which is that we're innovative and we have high mobility, but those simply aren't true anymore. So when we think about inequality, we have to sort of acknowledge, yes, it's about fairness, that's true, mm-hmm. but really it's about opportunity and it's about the incentives And right now, with such high inequality and so much of it at the top not coming from the kinds of investments we need to make in people and in technology, I mean, the humans that create that new technology, we are really shooting ourselves in the foot in terms of both, I mean, I think, quite frankly, short-term, but especially medium to long-term economic growth and stability.
And to those out there, listen, this is on the Progress Channel, so they're mostly progressives, but we have some Trumpers who listen and some conservatives who listen. They monitor. For them, and speaking to those who are maybe moderates, can you tell me that the smaller gap in income inequality, why is it actually good for our economy? And what I mean specifically is it not true that during the times of the smallest gap in income inequality that our nation economically grew? Like it's good for all of us. Is that a correct understanding from what I've read?
That is. Now, let me give you an example. There are a bunch of researchers at the International Monetary Fund that have been looking at this for almost a decade now. And one of the things that they have found is that countries that have high levels of inequality, like the United States, tend to have less stable paths of economic growth. They tend to be more prone to economic crises. And when you think about the enormous damage that was done during the Great Recession, right, this, mm-hmm. We have this massive run-up in an asset bubble. It crashes. You have this destruction of so much economic wealth and jobs and well-being. And that's what they're talking about, that places that are more unequal tend to have shorter spells of economic growth and are more prone to these kinds of crises that are, don't happen all the time, but when they do, are devastating. I mean, it was only recently that the typical American family saw their income back up to where it had been before the Great Recession, and that took almost a decade. So there's, you know, all of that time of lost income that families have faced is correlated with living in an economy with high inequality. Let me give you another concrete example, sure. Which is there are some researchers, and they just got a lot of attention recently, who were looking at who gets a patent in the United States. Now, patents are only one measure of innovation, but they are correlated with people having ideas that are going to spur, you know, growth and vitality and competitiveness in the U.S. economy. And what they found is that they had data on children and the test scores that these kids have when they're in school and their parents' income. And then they also know whether or not, as adults, those children grow up to get patents. And what they found was that children from wealthier families who were smart and got good test scores when they were kids in school were more likely to get patents. Mm-hmm. That makes sense. But they also found that kids who were really smart when they were little, who grew up in poorer families, when they grew up, were not likely to get patents, not nearly as much as those kids who grew up in rich families. And that is exactly the kind of thing that lowers growth for our society overall, right? You've got what they call these, quote, missing Einsteins, right? These mm-hmm. these smart kids, but because they don't have opportunity, because it's being obstructed by inequality, they are not able to have that innovation get to market and create these, you know, wonderful new things that we all love to buy, but that more fundamentally create a more competitive economy. So those are just two examples of how it is really the case that inequality drags down economic growth and stability.
And the personal impact it has that you're touching on is such an important point. I'm chatting with Heather Boucher, Executive Director and Chief Economist at the Washington Center for Equitable Growth. When I was doing preparation for this, and I've read some books on income inequality because it's something that intrigues me. And as I learn more about it, it's remarkable how it seeps in beyond just economic numbers. And it's about human lives that are impacted. One thing you touched on, I wanted to touch on this, the idea of economic mobility, that in the United States now, a child born at a certain lower economic level, the chances of moving up the ladder keeps getting smaller and smaller in this country, that it's almost cruel to dream the American dream for some people. Is that an effect? Is that one of the symptoms of income inequality?
100%. And this is so striking. So researchers have found that among children born in the 1940s, about 90% of them, when they grew up, earned more, as much or more than their parents. And you fast forward to kids born in 1980, and now only about half of kids grow up to earn as much or more than their parents. That's a sharp and significant decline in mobility over just, you know, a couple generations. It's really quite striking. And I think it explains a lot about how people perceive the political process. And, you know, so if you think about some of the frustrations that people have with our economy, like, wow, it used to be that most people grew up and did better than their parents.
Right.
And now that's not the case. But one of the things, you know, one of the stories we tell is like, well, you know, that's not about inequality, right? We have this economic mobility, American dream, and all of that. But one of the things that these researchers found was that even if the United States had had higher growth rates for those kids born in 1980, if we'd seen higher growth rates comparable to the growth rates that we saw in the 1940s, because there were faster growth then, that wouldn't have been enough to create that kind of economic mobility that we saw in the 1940s because of the high inequality. That actually today's high inequality is preventing economic mobility, and if we want to see economic mobility rise again, we're going to have to do something about economic inequality. And quite frankly, we're going to have to stop thinking about inequality just as a problem about the poor, but we're really going to have to focus on making sure that there are routes all the way up and that we do something about the top, which is, of course, exactly the opposite of the policy direction we've gone this week.
and I want to get into how, you know, tangible ways to close the income inequality gap, but I still want to get to a couple of things here more about the impacts, because from what my understanding, and you're the expert, so when I say my understanding, I'm not an economist. I'm a lawyer, I'm a writer, I'm a comedian, this is what I do. So when you have less chance for social mobility, economic mobility, it would mean to me that if you're born in a high poverty neighborhood, you have less of a chance of getting out there, meaning that you're more almost sentenced to a place with less, the education system not as good, because property values or property taxes are what pays for education. So if you're born in a low-income area, in a neighborhood or a city, and you have less chance of getting out, it's furthered and replicated because you're in a system, low taxes. You don't have the tax base, making it harder to get the education, because education is one of the ways to change the income inequality gap, is my understanding. So is that fair to say that the lack of economic mobility just furthers this cycle that we're having for certain people?
Well, and yes, and what you're getting at is the insidiousness of it, right? When we talk about inequality, and I, you know, it's this abstract idea, right? It's like, well, some people have more and some people have less. Like, what's the problem? But what we're trying to do in this conversation today is really show that there are real impacts. And if that is associated with people not being able to move up the economic ladder, part of what that is you're 100% right. It's about what kind of education do people have access to. But more importantly, sometimes it's actually about what kind of health care do they have access to? Mm-hmm. What kind of prenatal care did their mom have access to? There is a new body of economic research showing that that birth weight is actually correlated with how much people earn later in life. Right, and there's a lot of studies showing this isn't just like a one-off.
That's interesting. I never heard this.
But what does that mean? That means that actually the development of humans, right? It's not just about what you're learning in college. It's about how are we caring for the next generation? How are we making sure that we're making the most of the talent in our society? And how are we making sure that we're not consigning some people to lives at the bottom of the income distribution, where they don't have opportunity and where they can't make something of themselves? That's not the kind of economy that's going to be competitive in the 21st century, and it's not the kind of economy that's going to create this kind of society that I certainly want to live in.
Right.
But it is all connected to how we're thinking about education, how we're thinking about healthcare, how we're thinking about basic infrastructure and transportation. All of these are connected, and the extent to which the high inequality that we're seeing, which is allowing some to pull very, very far apart and not think about those public investments, is a corrosive impact on the kinds of goods and services we need to create the kind of future and current labor force that's going to grow our economy. So these are all connected issues. So I'm really glad that you tease that out.
Well, I try to do research before we do this, because I'm also interested in learning about this, because it's a topic that I think really has to be discussed more and addressed more. And I think Bernie Sanders did a good job of raising it on a national level. And, you know, and I've read like Joseph Stiglitz's book and Robert Reich's, and you start learning about this stuff and you opened your eyes. And what you just said is something I was not aware of, that birth weight can be an indicator for later success in life. So it goes back to prenatal care and a mother having the nutrients and the food she needs so the child is born full weight and not underweight. And that's also interrelated to our safety net with our government programs. So if the government cuts those prenatal care for mothers, it continues the cycle. It even implicates income inequality on some level, which is something I never thought of until you just said that about that study. It's not something I would ever be aware of.
It's important for us to understand that kind of opportunity that we created in the middle of the 20th century, where you know, you had less inequality, you had neighborhoods where, you know, everybody was kind of getting access to the same thing, but we were making massive investments in healthcare, in education, in infrastructure, and, you know, in many ways, I feel like we're living on the fumes of those investments that we made in the middle part of the 20th century, and we haven't upgraded so much, so many of those basic investments, but they are really what created that fantastic labor force that could create the vibrancy for our economy. And to the extent that we're not doing that because of politics, because of the way that the corrosive impact that inequality has on our political process, it's a tragedy for us all. Because for each of those kids that's super smart but doesn't actually get to have their talent be able to find its place in our economy, we all lose out. Our economy becomes less competitive, and that's gonna bring us all down. So it's this massive benefit to us, but we just have to see it.
So I think now everyone understands. I do. I know I do more about income inequality, sort of the nuances, not just the definition, but the impact on it. So when we get to the GOP tax plan that just passed the House and the Senate, and President Trump is expected to sign it into law in the near term, what will that do in terms of the income inequality gap?
It's only going to make it worse.
And
I mean,
why?
there's no two ways of. I mean, and I think it's really quite remarkable that the real consensus among economists that this is the case. You see a lot of people, a lot of economists, you know, weighing in and just saying this does not make sense. It's exacerbating inequality. It is starving our nation of the funds that we need to make the investments in our future that we so desperately need to be making. And it's going to push us in 100% the wrong direction. So it's a real tragedy. And, you know, you can also, you can see some of the evidence in this that there's absolutely no bipartisan support for it. Mm-hmm. And I think that is to the detriment of the quality of the bill. It was a really just a shameful process that didn't really focus on what's best for all of America.
I think it comes as no surprise to anyone that a Republican-controlled Congress and president would sign into law and champion a bill that's going to help the wealthy and the corporations and the rest of us get crumbs or have nothing. So let's get into what should be done. What should our government be doing if we were going to advocate? If politicians, we're going to have 20 Democrats run for president in 2020, I'm sure, and even some Republicans. What should people who want to make change for the better and close the income inequality gap? Because as we've just heard, it's better for everyone, folks, from the rich to the poor. It helps all of us to close this gap, makes our nation more efficient, and social mobility moves up. There's so many factors. What is a couple of concrete things that elected officials can advocate and should be championing?
Well, I think we need to go back to one idea that I heard in my time in Washington, you know, all the time up until this year, which is that if you're going to do corporate tax reform, make it revenue neutral. Mm-hmm. You're supposed to close the loopholes and make it more sensible and more sane. And instead, we haven't done that in this piece of legislation. We've opened up this massive deficit. So I think going back and thinking about, well, what kind of tax reform do we need on the corporate side that can increase the level of revenues back up to at least where it was, if not further, right? We are starving our society of those revenues. And, you know, for a long time, Republicans were on board with this idea of revenue-neutral tax reform, and that just went out the window this year to their detriment. So I think that's one. But I think more generally, we do need to be focusing on the revenue question. Mm-hmm. You know, we are an advanced economy with a lot of important investments we need to be making. We have, an aging infrastructure. We have, communities across the country that still don't have access to reliable broadband. We have an education system that is failing to keep up with other countries. We are not making those investments in early childhood education we need to make, and we're not making the investments in healthcare, let alone the fact that we've got an aging population that we're going to need to maintain and support. So we need to be thinking about revenues, and I mm-hmm. think key among those is rethinking, to what extent do we want those at the top to create these fortunes and amass them at historically in world history unprecedented amounts of money that these folks yep. have, and do we want the tax system to promote that? So I would start by thinking about the estate tax, think about how we're taxing capital, both individually and at the in corporations, and rethinking whether or not we're going to privilege. I mean, which is just crazy that what we've done in this tax bill is we've lowered taxes on capital relative to labor. And what that means is that you're going to pay more in taxes if you work for a living and you're out there, earning your income by the sweat of your brow than if you're just sitting back waiting for your dividends to come in. That is not the way the U.S. tax system has ever worked. And that's something that I think we also need to reconsider.
We only have a few minutes left. Let me ask you specifically about a few things that politicians talk about. And you tell me, we'll go through like three of them, but briefly, if you think this helps. There's no silver bullet, but raising the minimum wage, does that help close the income inequality gap?
Yes.
And why?
Certainly. Well, so I'm like, yes.
No. We have like two or three. It's up to, but we have like three. I don't know how much more time you have, but if you have 3 or 4 minutes, I'd love to ask you about three different one of these. So go ahead.
Yes,
minimum
certainly.
Wage is the first one. So we hear that a lot. Certainly. What will that do?
Raising the minimum wage boosts incomes at the bottom. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't just boost incomes for those who are paid the minimum wage, but for those who are paid a little bit more than the minimum wage. The best available this is one of the most studied issues in all of labor economics, and the consensus is that it has little to no effect on employment. I mean, when you sort of put all the studies together, it doesn't pull down the number of jobs in the community. What it does is raises incomes. Certainly is going to help inequality.
Okay, that's one. What about the idea of free college education, be it community college or even a vocational school or a 4-year college, state colleges? Would that help close the income inequality gap?
So that's a fine idea. However, mm-hmm. I think that the weight of the evidence at this point is that if you want to close that gap, you need to close that gap before that kid got to kindergarten. And that is where America is so far behind and where we leave low-income families in the lurch like no other country does. American families do not have access to safe, affordable, and enriching childcare or early childhood education in communities all across the country. And for families that have to work for a living, which, by the way, is the vast majority of them, and certainly low-income families, not having that really fantastic place for your kid to be while you're at work, that is the biggest issue that is affecting the quality, the future quality of the education of our workforce, I think. I mean, I agree with free college. That sounds great. But if I had that money, I would focus on the kids that aren't old enough to work yet. And I would say, yeah, we're going to do more to make sure that you can get to that place and that more kids are eligible to go to college. And then we'll focus on, I think that's a second order issue.
Oh, that's a good point. And what about last thing? We just lowered, not we, they, lowered the highest tax rate from 39.6% to 37%. What if that was reversed? What if it was raised to like 41 or 42% on the top income earners? Is raising the taxes on the more wealthy incomes a way of closing the income inequality gap?
Well, so you just said something very interesting, which is the word wealthy. Mm-hmm. And I think that what we need to do is really think hard about the difference between income from earnings and income from wealth, right? That interest that you get on your dividend payments or, you know, your rental income or something. And, you know, for the most part, those at the very, very top of the income ladder are getting a lot of money from their capital investments. And making sure that we are taxing those and have a really progressive vision for how we're going to tax capital, I think needs to be at the top of our agenda. That 2 percentage point on income, that's important, and I certainly think we need to raise it as a part of a broader revenue raising strategy. Mm-hmm. But we also need to make sure that we think about inheritance. We need to make sure that we think about the extent to which we're letting a lot of folks at the very top of the income distribution off the hook of paying the gains in their capital investments.
So capital gains tax increase would be one thing that is a good idea to close the gap?
Certainly, and then making sure that we're capturing all of those gains, that we're not allowing some of them to be passed on to their children without taxing that increase that happened over a lifetime. I think these are really important things. And too often this debate focuses on what this does to small businesses. That's certainly an important issue. There are certainly ways to make sure that people can pass on a business without also allowing people who are not passing on businesses but who are just passing on large stocks of wealth. Let's, you know, think about the Trump children, for example, who are right. inheriting a lot of money, supposedly, mm-hmm. But is now not going to be taxed or taxed at a much lower level. Is that fair? Is that, to me, that sounds like we're trying to create an aristocracy, which is kind of why we founded America in the first place, right. is to not do that. So
all right, so raising, and it would take a lot of courage for a politician to run in 2020 for president of the United States of America and say, I want to raise taxes on the top 1% or even on the capital gains tax or the pass-through tax. Those are almost non-starters, and the Republicans know that. By getting this through, it's hard for a Democrat to articulate that unless they make an amazingly compelling case, which would take a lot of people listening to the whole discussion we've had, having the discussion with people about why closing the income inequality gap is truly good for everyone from the bottom to the top. It helps all of us. We're in this together, and we need the revenue from some of the wealthy people to fund the programs like pre-K and prenatal so that the people can be competitive. Because you make a great point, Heather, it starts there. It doesn't start just at college. So I've learned a lot here today, and I hope others did as well. Any last thing you want to add about, by the way, any truth at all from an economist's point of view, cutting the corporate tax rate by 40% will mean wages will go up of employees?
Well, I wish that were true. Certainly, hopefully some of that money will be reinvested and that'll be a good thing for the economy. Time will tell. And whether or not that will quote unquote trickle down. We have a lot of evidence from history that that's not the way things work out.
Right.
But
evidence doesn't matter. Evidence is one of the words banned by the Trump administration, I think.
Totally.
That was one of the evidence, science is banned. The CDC just had 7 words banned. And I think scientific
Crazy.
Evidence was based on it. Yep.
Let me end with just one point
sure,
about the future of raising taxes. So one of the things that I think we need to be making sure that people are aware of is just how unpopular this legislation is, right? This is, if you'd asked us a year ago whether or not Democrats would have signed on to this bill or whether or not it would be popular to give people even a modest tax break, I think we would have thought, oh, yeah, people would like that, and, yeah, this would get bipartisan support. The fact that you got no bipartisan support mm-hmm. and that the poll after poll shows that it is enormously unpopular and people understand that they are not going to get anything
yes,
out of it.
Yes, people got it. People
I
are getting it now.
A lot of room.
I think even people on both the left and the right, there's a sense of cynicism we all have now. And there's also people are paying attention now. So when you see polls where even Republicans poll say, no, I'm not going to see any benefit on this, and they don't care, or 2/3 think Donald Trump personally will prosper from this, which he will. We all know it. It's completely documented. It's not even opinion, that they get that. And I think that's what rubs some people the wrong way, that the rich, and because oddly enough, Donald Trump and Bernie Sanders both were saying the system was rigged for different reasons. But that resonated with people, that the people have worked really hard. They have not moved up the ladder. They've seen the rich get richer, which is objectively quantified as accurate. The poor have gotten the same or less, and the middle class wages have stagnated. And people are like, and now you're giving another tax cut to the wealthy and corporations? And then you're going to cut programs for my grandma who's on Medicare, or my mom or dad who's on Medicare, because that's what they're going to do next, and Medicaid, and you're gutting the ACA entitlement mandate. it rubs people the wrong way. People are paying attention both on the left and the right. That's why I think we're going to see politically the result in 2018. Who knows? But we'll see. But Heather, I want to thank you very much for taking so much time going through this. I learned a lot, and I really appreciate your time. And you're doing great work as the executive director and chief economist at the Washington Center for Equitable Growth. And I hope to have you back on in the future to make me and all of us smarter.
Well, thank you. This has been fun. Thanks a lot.
Thanks, Heather.